Hello, and welcome to The Hump with Katie Thoreau. I'm your host, Katie Thoreau, and I'm bringing you interviews with some incredible artists, finding out why are they so amazing, how did it all happen, and what can we learn from their journey. Before we get started today, I'd like to thank our sponsors. And first up, we have Kohlsteins. Kohlsteins is one of my most favorite string shops to visit in the entire world. They're based in Long Island, New York, and anytime I'm in New York City, I make a special trip to Kohlsteins to see what new things they've got going on. They do it all. They do everything from instrument repair, and they build beautiful double basses. They make their own strings and rosin and bass bibs. They have everything. I call it the Disneyland of basses. And the staff there is just incredibly nice, so helpful and knowledgeable. Go to Kohlstein.com and use the promo code KD10, and you'll get 10% off your entire purchase. Or give them a call, and you'll get the discount as well. That's Kohlstein.com. Okay, and up next, we have Jams World. By now, you all know how much I love Jams World. I'm wearing one right now. It's a clothing company based in Honolulu, Hawaii, that's been family-owned and operated since 1964. The fabric is so cool and so comfortable because it's made from 100% spun-crushed rayon. And it's real art that's screen-printed onto the fabric. I feel like I'm wearing something so unique and made just for me. Go to jamsworld.com and use the promo code JAZZ15 and you'll get 15% off your entire online purchase. That's jamsworld.com. I'd also like to remind you that I'm bringing you brand new episodes of The Hump every Wednesday, every hump day. Download and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and follow us on Instagram. You don't want to miss a beat of what's going on at The Hump. I'm so honored to introduce our guest today, the bassist Richard Simon. I call him the unsung hero, and I think that plenty of people know who Richard is, but I would like more people to know about him. His story is so inspiring. He didn't start playing bass until he was 30 years old, and he made it his business to learn the music, to play with musicians, and now many years later, he's been a top call musician in Los Angeles, touring all over the world. And the other aspect of Richard that I really love is his passion for education. So I'm so excited for you to dig into this interview. Without further ado, here's Richard Simon.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. How have you been?
You know, all things considered, I mean, I have no new complaints. Some people are doing much worse, and some people I know have had the coronavirus and recovered. Mm-hmm. But I have a little routine, and I managed to stay with it, and I'm, of course, staying close to the bass. I even bought a bass recently, not that I needed another one, but so I really think that, of course, I miss playing music with other people. Mm-hmm. But then everybody has had to make sacrifices. So, I really think it's been pretty benign so far.
Yeah, I kind of take that approach as well. Not that things could always be worse, but I'm fed and I have a house over my head. At least I get to play my instrument. I'm so excited to talk to you because I love talking to people that I know. And then I find out like a lot of other things that ended up shaping their life and career.
Ah, okay. So, well, I have to be, if you'll excuse my interruption. I just want your legion of fans to know that I've known you for a long time and that I don't know how this ranks in the history of your recorded output, but this took place, maybe 15 years ago, and you were a mere child. Of course, you still are in many ways. This was you and Jazz America. I guess you might have been a junior or a senior in high school. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But the Jazz America program had a stellar band that year, and we thought we better capture it for all time because some of these young people are going to become stars. And here you are. You've fulfilled the promise. So I just wanted the world to know that you're more than just a great musician. You have a history, and that you made such a deliberate, conscientious study of jazz, and your many accomplishments precede you. But I feel a special connection because in the capacity of helping to run Jazz America, I was able to witness your early stage, and you've just made phenomenal progress since then. And the recording stands up. You sang I Didn't Know About You, the Duke Ellington.
Okay, yeah.
Ballad, and possibly another tune. I'd have to look. But some of the others in that band went on to pursue music, a couple of trombone players. One of them is a freelance classical trombonist. Mm. Of course, we lost Austin Peralta, yeah. the great piano prodigy. But here you are. So thank you for giving Jazz America such a great reputation and for being a beacon.
Well,
of course, beacon are moving people, but you continue to move people.
Well, thank you for the nice sentiments, but I'm supposed to be doing that right now for you, Richard.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah. Sorry. By the way, this is my first Skype. All this time, I thought that that was how Aussies get out of prison.
Skype. Yeah,
right.
I get it.
Thank you for clearing that up for me.
Yeah, and to the listeners, when you listen to this, you'll be dazzled and wowed by Richard's way to just the tapestry of his language and the way that...
Oh, that is a lovely metaphor. I didn't like, but yeah. that was exception. Thank you.
So just get ready for more of that. But Richard, you are... we've all had this, like after a gig, someone comes up to you and it's usually an older man, not to be gender specific, but it's usually an older man that says, I played bass in high school in the class of 1956 and I wish I kept up with it.
Right.
And that's happened to you. It's happened to me. And then they might turn it into a hobby, right? Like they might like say, I got, you know, a bass 10 years ago. I picked it back up again and I play with my friends.
Right.
But you took that to the nth degree. So I might go back and forth here, but because I knew it's like, I knew you didn't start playing bass till later, but you had an early musical career and just went a different way, right?
Yes, I wanted to play the trombone, but my arms were too short, so I had to let it slide, as it were. But I had a grandfather who escaped World War II in Europe with a violin. So I took up the violin, took private lessons, got in the school orchestra, made it to the local youth symphony in Kansas City, my hometown. And in thinking about this conversation, I wanted to see if I could figure out how it was that music played such a role in my life mm-hmm. late. And it turned out that the decade of my violin beginnings coincided with the golden age of the Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein collaborated to make history with just a profusion of brilliant lyrics and music. And that music was really all around mm-hmm. everywhere. There wasn't such a demarcation between young and old music back mm-hmm. then. A little before I was born, people of all generations were dancing to the same music,
yeah.
dancing the same dances and loving the same music. So the Broadway era also seemed to appeal to people of all ages. So in my little school orchestra, we would get pieces from My Fair Lady
mm-hmm.
or The Music Man, or eventually, I think in the late 50s, West Side Story. And these tunes were so melodic, quite often we didn't bother to learn the lyrics, but this was part of the seed that was planted, and I didn't nurture it deliberately. Mm-hmm. I eventually put the violin aside for baseball and eventually English literature. But what was fermenting was that music, the music of television, mm-hmm. and television in those days had many live bands.
Yeah.
There was a Merv Griffin who was a talk show host and a singer, and he had a terrific band. And in his band were people like Plaz Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no way of knowing that 30 or some years later, I was privileged to play with Plaz.
That's interesting, because a lot of times, sorry to cut you off, but like people will look at the TV and go, one day I'm going to play with that person, or I'm going to act with this person. But you're just ingesting it and taking it in.
I just loved the sound, and I didn't know why. I knew it was great, but I couldn't really put words to it. Ed Sullivan had a variety show. There was every night there were musical shows with people like the King family, a bunch of sisters who were all musical. And again, years later, I worked with Marilyn King. The Tonight Show, when it was in New York and then Los Angeles, was a jazz band, but I didn't identify it as such. I didn't know jazz per se, but I just knew that this music was powerful and played brilliantly, flawlessly, which was more than I could say about my violin playing. So, and at the same time, my father was a self-taught piano owner. Mm. And so he could make any song come out like a polka. He had a very percussive left hand. It was mostly, his left hand was mostly roots, fifths, and spankings. So that made a big impression on me. So there was a lot going on around me, not so much from within. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just had big ears, and I just was transported by music, a little bit of classical. And so it was kind of an unspoken language that I was soaking up without really being conscious of it.
Yeah. And it kind of like back in your day, you gave us some dates a little bit, but it was kind of normal for most everybody to play a little bit of piano, even read music. Like it wasn't out of the ordinary to be familiar with it.
That's right. And for that, I am eternally grateful, because as much as I began to resist the violin lessons, I had a pretty good ear. Mm-hmm. So even if I wasn't the greatest student or practicer, my ear kind of brought me along. And again, it was partly because of the influence of what I was hearing on the radio and seeing on TV. But yeah, it really helped to learn music, to read music. And then along came the bass clef, which I thought was just massively unfair that they would put the same notes on the wrong spaces line, make us bass readers. I don't know. Did you learn treble clef first, or did you learn bass clef first?
I learned treble, and it was not great. I think we both share the same violin passion. Like it didn't work out. Just wasn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you started on violin?
Started on violin when I was 4, and then when I was 8, it was just like we could switch to a different instrument. And my mom suggested the bass, because she said, everyone needs a bass player, so you'll always have a job.
Smart mom.
Yeah. I didn't think of it that way at the time, but it is true.
Well, mother knows best.
Yeah. Before I go on chronologically, and what you mentioned about like just hearing those songs and ingesting them, the Broadway tunes, because they're just so well written with the melody and the lyrics. And so that was easily ingrained in you. And I kind of think all the time, music, most popular music is missing that now. And so I think like, wow, my neighbors who blast, you know, whatever, like when they're 90 in a retirement home, are they going to be, you know, singing along to that? Is that going to like make them feel good?
That's a good question. Well, it's refreshing to hear someone as young as you have the same reaction as someone as old as I am, because there is a sort of paucity of melody these days. I mean, there's plenty of rhythm, but I think melody is sort of taking a decade off, and maybe the pendulum will swing back and we'll start whistling a happy tune again before too long. But see, you managed to play melodically, and that had to come from maybe your violin training. I mean, how is it that you, when you solo, you're not a geometrical soloist. You're not following Simandl across the fingerboard. You are following lines that you also manage to sing. So I wanted to ask you at some point which comes first, or is it all just together and spontaneous? And are you aware? Is the bird of inspiration sitting on your shoulder, whispering melodies into your ear?
Well, get your own podcast. No, I will answer this question because it has a lot to do with you, actually. So, I forget how old I was when I met you. I don't know, maybe 12 or 13. But yeah. I remember I didn't know theory at all whatsoever. Even when I was playing violin and even playing bass, I couldn't read music. And I would memorize the concertos, like the Capuzzi. I remember being in 10 years old. I memorized it from the recording. But my teacher was like, oh, it's in a different key, your paper. I didn't know. So I just learned everything by ear. And then, like you, I just had a lot of music on. I loved old country music, and there was classical music, and my mom had really great jazz records. So it was like just a lot of high level information.
Right.
And I don't think of myself as a high level person, but that music, you know, is coming in. So it's there somewhere.
Right.
And I remember being at the Sweet and Hot Jazz Festival at Jazz America.
Right.
And, which is no longer, but it was a great festival in Los Angeles. And I don't really remember who the group was. It was like four singers and the bass player didn't show up.
Mm.
And instead of you playing the gig, maybe you just didn't want to play it. But I was there walking along with my bass and you said, Katie can do it. And I think I was maybe 15 or 16.
Mm.
And I was like, well, what are they playing? There's no music. What are they playing? And you're like, you'll be fine. So I just heard everything by ear. And that's kind of what really started that, that foyer into just like, okay, I have my ear, let me use it.
Right.
And it was cool. Cause then I would play you would call, you're like, I can't make sangrias, you know? And I'm like, well, what are they playing? And you're like, you'll hear it. And it's cause I'd heard all those tunes and I might not even know the name of the song.
Right.
The key, I had no idea what was going on. At one point, Doug Webb had said, you know, you could play every single song, but you don't know any of them. So it was just my ear. And then the fun part was later going, okay, this is just friends. This chord that it starts on is not the chord, the key that we're in. So kind of like later putting the pieces back together.
Right.
So when it comes to like when I solo and play bass lines, I think it just comes back to all that ear playing. And I'm just I feel like the voice is just our instrument, no matter what instrument we play, if you play one instrument. So I just always come back to that as my original instrument. And I just find a way for it to come out.
It's great. It's magic, isn't it? I mean, we don't have to create a formula or a theorem or an equation. We have this gift. I mean, that's the only way I can explain it. And when we're lucky, everything flows. I mean, obviously there are times when, oh my God, like I remember being thrown in, as I guess I threw you in, to the pool on a gig with Buddy Collette, who was one of my mentors and the founder of Jazz America. And the second chord of the tune that the pianist played was so elusive. Mm-hmm. And he played maybe eight choruses. I never once got it right. Mm. And it had such a flavor, that chord. It was so delicious, but it was out of reach.
Yeah.
It eluded me. And it turned out it was a diminished chord.
Mm-hmm.
And it was named correctly because I felt so diminished after playing that tune. But Buddy and the pianist was a man named Gildo Mahonas, who was from the Caribbean Islands, but made his career in New York, terrific bebop player and accompanied Lambert, Hendrix, and Roth for many years, said nothing, gave me a Mona Lisa smile through the whole tune. And I think those older guys who were my mentors were so kind in not being judgmental, and they knew that I was trying so hard. And of course, afterward, I made it my business to learn the diminished chord and to learn some theory and kind of back construct, what's that called, reverse engineer my understanding of why things are the way they are. And it turned out the tune was Witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, well, Witchcraft is going to bring me to shore here, because none of the notes I was playing was correct. And, you know, it's probably an obvious sonority to some people. And now it's one of my favorite sounds, of course, the half diminished and so forth, and how it isn't necessarily a chord, but it, it can be seen as some of the extension notes of another chord.
Exactly.
So all that began to coagulate and make sense. But I did appreciate the sense of wonder that, am I going to know the tune? Or
even
this note wasn't always revealed. And I was comforted in hearing Larry Grenadier say that in one of your other interviews. Mm-hmm. When he was just starting out, he'd be on a bandstand. No one would call.
Yeah.
No one would call the key. They would just start. Mm-hmm. And I remember playing with an old time pianist who said, let's just do Stealing Apples.
Yeah.
I thought, okay. And off he went. I think that happened at Sweet and Hot, mm-hmm. all places. But there's been so much of that. And I don't want to anticipate. Well, I'll let you speak. But if I can remember the point I was about to make, I'll throw it in at the appropriate time.
No, that's great, because it's also that recall. Like, someone calls Stealing Apples. If someone called that, I'd be like, okay, that's Woody Herman, right? And so I might have to think really quick. But like, I remember actually one day in Jazz America, there was another bass player who was having trouble. Maybe we were learning something by ear. And he was like, how do you just hear the roots? And you were like, do what Katie does. You just start on one and then you just figure it out chromatically. And then you might ask the piano player, where's the bridge go?
Right.
It's like, if you just have these little pieces of information, you kind of realize, well, there's a lot of the songs are the same.
Right.
You know, so you just, I think sometimes bass players in particular freak out because, oh, I need to learn 3,000 songs. It's like, no, just learn like 10 different chord patterns and you're cool.
Exactly. That's so true. I mean, I think that's kind of a frightening bit of news for a lot of student musicians. They think of songs as discrete little Lego building that they have to build from the ground up. But I think you do a lot of teaching. I'm guessing that, well, I know you have a clinic in Maui and so forth. I mean, a camp. But it's great that you have that capacity, and I think it comes as really wonderful news to students who are otherwise stuck behind the eight ball. Oh my God, do I start with the letter A in the index, or do I go by composers? But also that helps with respect to keys, because when you scope out the contour of the changes, like a tune you don't know, and you hear it, you play it once with a group, and then you kind of have it, or you kind of have part of it, and then no matter what key it's in, you pretty much have it. Like the next time a singer calls it, or somebody who can only play in G flat or something. and then of course there are people who learn by Roman numerals. Mm-hmm. I love their watches, which are, you know, Roman. But so it's really a strange animal that we run with, and so many people learn different ways. But I think, and if I dare put myself in the same place as you, I think that when we have that understanding, that sort of non-literal or that kind of three-dimensional relationship to music and to sound and to pitches, and it's such a benefit. It's so so just priceless. And I just sometimes think, especially with students who are struggling, that if I could give them a pill to get them through that feeling of, oh my God, look at how much I have to learn. But people come to that in various ways, and people never do. But it's really what makes what we do. I mean, classical musicians maybe don't need that, because they're maybe more technique oriented. I mean, I don't want to go down that path because I don't know any of those people. But we have, as improvisers, such a precious capacity. And it's just something to be grateful for every day.
I agree. Yeah, you really get to, every day is different. Every time you play is different.
Right. I mean, I thought I had a system. There's the, I think it's called the harmonic minor scale. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I'm not the only one, even on this block. But I came with this exercise starting on the low E string. Are we among nerds here?
There are a couple nerds, yeah.
Okay. I mean, musical nerds, not computer nerds. If you play the E minor scale, I mean, yeah, the E minor scale with a flat six and a raised seven, I think you have a harmonic minor scale.
Yeah, that is correct.
So if you play it as an arpeggio, you go from the low E to the E on the D string. Mm-hmm. And then your next octave takes you up to the E on the G string. And then you might as well take it up to the B on the G string. You may not be able to go past that and then take it back down again. Well, the next time you go through the exercise, you're going to start on the second note of that E minor, E harmonic minor scale, F sharp, and play every other note of the same E minor scale. Mm-hmm. So F sharp, A, C, E, which gives you a minor six chord, which is called various things, right? I mean, they've given it other names, but take that up as high as you can and back down. Then you start on the third degree. I'm giving you the third degree right now.
Yeah.
That minor scale, G, B, D sharp, F sharp, which is kind of a augmented.
Yeah.
Is it? Okay.
It is.
And, yeah. And then if you start on the fourth degree of the scale, A, C, E, G, you've got a minor seven.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start on the fifth degree, you've got a B, D sharp, F sharp, A, which is a good old dominant seven.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you go to the flat six, this is such a surprise. C natural, E, G, B natural.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought that Mr. Vanilla himself, the C major seventh, would be hidden within the E harmonic minor? And then the last note of that scale, the D sharp, F sharp, A, C, is the fully diminished seventh.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured if I took these up and down and changed the fingering on the way down, I would be more in command of the fingerboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you finish that, have a drink.
Yeah.
Then you go and start on the F and do the same thing, up as many octaves as you can and back down again. So it did accomplish something. It gave me command of that exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure how much benefit it has in... But I do think, I mean, even though I don't quote that or I don't use patterns based on that exercise, I think that it has value in that at any given time, I can pretty much know where to find the intervals across the string,
exactly.
How much shifting I need to do. But in and of itself, I'm only harping on this because if there are any students out there, sometimes exercises or patterns are worth their weight in the pattern themselves,
yeah.
And don't necessarily contribute to your musicality.
Mm-hmm.
But they're worth knowing. And I don't know what made me jump on that, but I call it necrophilia.
Wow. So
I guess that's a long way around getting to a pun. But I think that things like that are valuable, like when you are first getting to know the fingerboard and you have Simandl kind of slapping his yardstick on your finger, play it in tune. If the man wanted it played that way, he would have written it that way. So you've got that, but this is kind of an ear exercise because it does, and you do it with a bow, so you can combine your long tone exercise with... And you're still hearing the pitches, and it helps with the shifting. And by going through all of those permutations of one harmonic minor scale, you are dealing with just about every chord, all the basic chords of a jazz standard.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
It doesn't cover the Joe Henderson and since then kind of chords, but a lot of our playing... commercially anyway, is based on standards and Broadway and that kind of material where those chords are useful.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, because a lot of times bass players are also overwhelmed. You could be playing for a long time, but they're overwhelmed by the fingerboard.
Yes.
And I remember seeing a clinic with Rufus Reed, and he said, he was like, a lot of people play the bass in an L shape. You know, they just go across and then down the G string.
Right.
And that was one of those things that actually like stuck in my brain when I saw that when I was a kid. Because it's so debilitating. There's so much instrument to play and also so much timbre. Yeah. Like you can play F on the D string on the fourth line. You could play that four different places and you might want to play it softly or muted, you know.
Right. It's true.
Yeah. So I'm going to try that. I don't do something similar, but yeah, I always tell students or like, you know, people having intonation problems, it's just get your landmarks together. So I like to go through arpeggios and so this is nerd time. And I like to approach them from a half step below.
Right.
So do any, you know, major, minor, augmented or whatever, and then above and then kind of enclose it. Just so you know, I can always play, you know, B flat on the A string, you know, further up, not down here.
Exactly. That's pretty easy. And recently discovered, oh, go ahead.
No. That's great. I'm done.
All right. I discovered a book by Sam Most, who has left us, but mm-hmm. he was a brilliant musician, flute and all the woodwinds, really. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called Metamorphosis, the mm-hmm. Transformation of the Jazz Solo. And in the early part of the book, which is out of print, but one of my students found it. Early book talks about chords the way we are and extensions mm-hmm. and whatnot. Some people like that. They carve that up and it works for them. But the majority of the book is not concerned with the names of chords, but how one little half step mm-hmm. creates a chord with a flat fifth or a flat ninth plus 11. And that part really appeals to me because he's taken about nine chord patterns without titles, mm-hmm. but can kind of figure it out. That sure sounds like all the things you are, or the chords.
Yeah.
And he will take you through a sample melody where he'll say, okay, we're going to embellish the root mm-hmm. of every chord. And he'll either go a half step above or half step below, or he'll decorate that note by going half step above, then a half step below, and then land on the note. Mm-hmm. And along the way, you go, oh my God, I've been hearing musicians play this forever. Yeah. I mean, even from the swing era, but certainly in bebop mm-hmm. and mainstream, it's up to the individual how he or she comes up with those embellishments and whether it could be just a visceral feeling thing that I'm going to linger a little bit below that note because mm-hmm. I feel that way, or I'm going to just scratch my fingernails on the chalkboard of my audience by hanging out above and then resolve. Whatever it is, creates such beauty. And I'm in such debt to Sam, whom I was fortunate to play with for the last maybe 10 years of his life. And I had no idea that he had written the book. Mm-hmm. And somebody mentioned it, and then he was gone, and I wanted to ask him about it. And there's a couple of misprints, but maybe that's me.
Yeah.
But it's so wonderful. And if anybody's wondering, how do I sneak by the definition of chords and get those beautiful sounds anyway, you can probably find at least an excerpt of it somewhere on the internet. So that's another approach. I mean, like you were saying, you get the timbre, you get different note qualities, mm-hmm. different places on the fingerboard, and you get the idea of, well, if I embellish a strong note, a strong chord tone. And he doesn't mess with sevenths. I mean, he'll say, embellish the root for a while, then embellish the third. And that opens up another kaleidoscopic view. And then embellish the fifth. Then I'm not really a fourths player. I mean, when that era came along, I love McCoy Tyner and all those players. I don't know about you. I mean, maybe may the fourths be with you.
Yeah.
It could be your preferred dish. But it's all about grabbing what you can from the masters. And that's something else I was so impressed with Larry Grenadier about, is that he always wanted to play with better players. Mm-hmm. And masters play, they don't talk, they don't tell you what to do or what not to do. I had the same blessing in that once Red Callender, my teacher, started throwing me out into that same pool we talked about. Nobody ever critiqued. Nobody, Teddy Edwards never said, don't do that. Or, mm-hmm. all, you know, he did, I have to edit that. One time he said at the end of a night, don't tap your foot while you play. Mm. It takes the torque out of your groove, mm-hmm. or words to that effect. And I haven't succeeded completely in not tapping. Do you tap your foot when you play?
Sometimes I tap on 1 and 3.
It really struck me. It was like, oh, I had no idea. But anyway, the tunes were, the feeling was so intense with all these older cats. The blues was the predominant attraction for me, not mm-hmm. just 12-bar blues, but how the wail of the human condition came through the playing, not just soloing, but mm-hmm. how a standard could be rendered. Something you'd heard all your life suddenly becomes this cry of desperation, or sometimes sarcastic, like, I've got this stuff wired. You know, you can kind of, singers are able to do that, where they'll just grind out the lyrics and you go, I've never heard the song done that sardonically before. Carmen McRae could do that.
Oh,
all of this is subjective.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I know what she's thinking when she's singing it this mm-hmm. way. I'm in the middle of a book on Lena Horne, and she had such a terrible, challenging young life that she came to kind of deliver songs with a clenched jaw much of the time. And she confesses in the book to the author and to others that this was her kind of getting back at people that hurt her. Mm. But audience thought, my goodness, listen to that pathos, and my man did this and my man did that. Meanwhile, she might be singing about her father, mm-hmm. all we knew. But that's why we're just, again, so lucky that we can do therapy on ourselves with the help of our mentors and our masters and our sidemen. And I think it's really a healthy way to express who we are and how we feel.
Yeah. And I'll make one point, and then I really want to get to your career. You're really, you know, skirting your own.
If I had a career, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Sorry. But you brought up you bring a really good point up about, like, this is also another thing, you know, playing based on feeling. Even in terms of, like, Sam Most, it's like, I'm going to embellish the root. And you can do so much if you just know the roots of a song. You can, like, you know, you can take a great solo if you just know the roots and just, oh, I'm going to go a half step above, and
exactly.
Oh, that feels good. So trying to help people, because that's why people like music. You like something because it feels good. So, and I think that's kind of my route too. It's playing more what you feel, and being okay with that. Like, it doesn't have to come from some big theoretical encyclopedia.
Right. Well, if you have a minute, I can summarize my career, but no, I'll let you ask and I'll.
Okay. So what I find so interesting about you, like I said at the beginning, is you did the impossible. So you didn't start your official music career till you were 30, until after did you get a master's in English literature?
I did a BA and then an MA, and I was minding my own business, grading papers in an office, when somebody down the hall turned on the jazz station and I heard Stefan Grappelli playing Undecided. Mm-hmm. And I dropped my red pencil and I dangled the participle I was correcting. And I just was transfixed by this music. Nobody had ever told me you could have that much fun with a violin. So almost immediately I made it my business to go find out about jazz. And there were two institutions nearby. One was El Camino College, mm-hmm. which had a terrific music department, many PhDs in the music department. And the other institution nearby was the Lighthouse Jazz Club.
Yeah.
So I made it my business to spend time in both. The Lighthouse, the first time I went, had Milt Jackson and a local rhythm section. I wasn't quite sure what I was hearing, but I enjoyed it. And the band took a break, and he came to the mic and said, oh, we're going to be taking a break, but I see a couple of my friends are in town. Oscar, Ray, and Joe Pass are here. Maybe we can talk them into playing a tune. So in they came. I was sitting in the old lighthouse church pew, which is how they had decked out the room, in the front row. And those folks who were announced sat in. And I swear the stage levitated. Mm-hmm. Such intensity. They swung so hard. I mean, it was like a religious thing. I mean, if I could have spoken in tongues, I might have, you know. And it made this incredible impression on me, and it reinforced the idea that I had discovered something that was valid, not only based on the Stefan Grappelli tune, but that there was this huge array of sound and intensity. And 'cause Grappelli was kind of a light touch guy. I mean, he had great chops, classical training, played with Django. And that represented kind of a genteel side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And when Oscar, Joe, and Ray played, and I think the drummer was Jimmy Smith, not the organist, but the drummer, I realized, my God, it's the entire range of human expression right here. And so then at the school, I decided I needed to know theory. There was a class called Survey of Jazz, which started with Louis Armstrong, and I hated the D word. I even hate to say Dixieland, but Dixie Cup, the original Dixie Cup jazz band, that music all the way forward. And the instructor, ironically enough, had played in the Lawrence Welk Jr.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Lawrence Welk, you're too young to remember him, he had his own band.
Accordion.
Yeah. And
lots
and
of bubbles all the time, too.
Bubbles. He was the champagne music maker.
Yeah.
The corniest show on the planet. But great songs, great musicians. His drummer was black and hid behind a paper mache palm tree so that his friends wouldn't know that he was playing, because the band was extremely of the Caucasian persuasion, both in its ethnicity and its choice of material. But his name was Paul Humphrey, and years later, I got to play with him. And my theory instructor, who was also a Welk guy, had written a PhD on the solos of Charlie Parker. Mm. He took and this was before computers, every lick of two notes or more that Bird recorded, cataloged them, and arranged them in, like, oh, this is an upward motive, or this was downward, or this one based on a triplet. And it was this enormous undertaking, two volumes, like an inch and a half thick. So I thought, this is a good thing, because I know Charlie Parker is a name that I should get to know. Mm-hmm. So theory, and one day, I had no instrument.
Yeah, I was about to say, when did the bass come into play?
Well, I went to the band room where they had a band, jazz band, and I thought, I had learned some guitar chords in college, you know, the C, F, and G. So I thought, maybe they need a guitar player, but I didn't know chords then. And in the back of the room were the 4K basses that used to occupy every band room in America. So I grabbed one. The action was extremely high, and I just started thumping, and I thought, this is it. I found my dance partner. So the flesh would peel off the skin, and I didn't care. And I even had a bit of a legal run-in. They allowed me to take the bass home, because I just knew right away this is what I had to learn how to play. And I don't think I even had a cover for it. They said, just, you know, be careful. Stuck it in my little Opel Cadet two-seater, and the scroll on the top of the bass stuck out the passenger window. I couldn't get it all the way in. So I'm on the 405 freeway, and the red light behind me, the siren get my attention. They pull me over, and the highway patrolman says, you know, you can't do that. You have to get off the freeway and do something with that. So he gave me a ticket, and I thought, okay, I'll wait till he leaves. I had only a few off ramps to go. Got another ticket. Another.
Oh my gosh.
So the guy says, you know, you're going to get these if you keep driving on the freeway. And so I got off. I couldn't pay the fine. Actually, I have to correct. The second one was just a warning. Okay. I didn't get the ticket. So I went to court on the date in question, waited my turn. The bailiff called my name. The judge read the citation and started laughing. Your Honor? And he said, yes, Mr. Simon. I don't want to correct him because, you know, yeah. He said, tell me this isn't what it sounds like. He said, the officer wrote instrument protruding. So I said, do I need to explain it? He said, yeah, I think you better. And I told him it was a bass. He got another laugh. Dismissed it. He said, I suggest you take the back seats out of your car. Maybe the bass will go through the trunk and you won't have this problem again. But I thought, you know, here I am. Well, I don't have to say anymore, but it was the closest I've come to being cited for indecent exposure. And it was the bass. Was indecently exposed. But it was just after that, it was just a lot of rehearsing with people. And I was 30, so I was older than the kids in the theory classes and whatnot. But we rehearsed relentlessly. I practiced forever. I had little gigs in shopping malls and wherever. And it didn't matter. It wasn't about the money. It was just learn tunes, get stamina, see how much your ear can absorb. And somebody told me to get a teacher, and I went to a classical teacher, got a little bit of bowing together. Then he said at some point, you know, if you want jazz, you need to find Red Calendar. Mm. So I went to a stationery store. No, that's not true. I found Red Calendar at a club in the Valley, San Fernando Valley, playing with Gerald Wiggins.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And they had a trio. And I said, Red, I'm studying the bass. I understand that you wrote the old hit song Primrose Lane, which was a hit in the 50s. He said, don't remind me. So I knew I had a soul brother there because he was so modest and he was playing just so deep, low notes mostly, did take some solos, but it was just this relaxed, wise kind of approach to the instrument. Lots of roots and fifths, but he knew exactly what to do with the wig. I mean, Gerald Wiggins could play like Art Tatum. He kind of styled himself after Tatum. And they were just so perfect together. So Red had a little school at the time. I auditioned for him and he accepted me. And he was just this guru. And he didn't have to resort to pedagogic approach. He'd say, well, I was in this movie called New Orleans with Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong, and it was a shame that they cast Billie as a maid, but to the point here, I was asked to play a bass fill in a tune that was an instrumental segueing to a vocal, but they needed to change key for the singer. And just as I was stuck not knowing what to do, the guy in charge in the studio said, oh, fellas, we're done for the day. We don't want to go overtime. We'll pick it up here tomorrow. So Red breathed a sigh of relief, went home and fooled around a little bit and came up with what was essentially a bebop bass lick. Mm-hmm. But they loved it. And so things like, and he taught me that in the lesson. And then another thing he said, you know, if you're in the studio, a lot of these writers don't know about the bass. So they might give you a D flat above the G harmonic. And he said, when there's a lull, he would put a little saliva on the ring finger and mark the D flat so that when the cue came, he had this little spot and he could nail it. And he knew exactly where to go. And by the end of the hour, there was no.
Yeah.
But little things like that were just golden. And at the end of the lesson, he did for me what he did for his first student, Charles Mingus, many years earlier. The lesson would end, the student pays, and Red takes you out to lunch on the bread that you just ate. So I, you know, had some great Cuban food with Red, and it was just the right person at the right time.
Yeah.
And then he started throwing me into that pool, and I was getting calls from Teddy Edwards and Johnny Kirkwood, who was a drummer with Louis Jordan and the organist Jimmy Smith. Ernie Andrews, with whom I know you've worked with him. And it was the creme de la creme of West Coast players, and they were mostly older. And I want to say this just because I think it needs to be said. They were almost all black. Mm-hmm. And I had had very little interaction with black people growing up in a border state, Missouri, still segregated. When I was teaching English, I was given assignments in the community of South, what was then called South Central LA, mm-hmm. where I had my first interaction with black people. And I would take a break after a morning session and say, I think I'm going to go to the convenience store on the corner and I'll be right back. And the students would say, I wouldn't go down there by myself. Let mm-hmm. one of us go with you. And we developed a rapport, and I'd say, look, I'm going to teach you the language of the man so mm-hmm. that you can construct grammatical paragraphs and get over in a way that expresses what you want said and gets you where you want to get. And I'm going to learn what I can from you about mm-hmm. life in the world. And somehow that crossed over into jazz.
Yeah.
But I think it was meant that I had the teaching experience in the community. I even taught a semester at Terminal Island Federal Correctional Institution.
Wow.
Talk about a captive audience.
Yeah. Right?
So I just was given this information and this way of life and this way of expressing oneself that had nothing to do with my life up until mm-hmm. that point. And I don't really think I was slumming. I know that I wasn't. I just feel that the musical manifestation of the humanity of the people that I encountered in the jazz world struck a chord in me and continues to. And partly I find, and along the way I found that that generation of musicians and the Central Avenue tradition, the mm-hmm. Dexter Gordons and the guys that came up out here, Eric Dolphy and people like that, and Buddy Collette and Ernie Andrews, that spoke to me. That was the kind of most important period and group that somehow resonated with me, and I don't know why. And I have to admit, like I referenced Joe Henderson earlier, much as I love his playing, it doesn't connect to me that way.
Yeah.
So I learn his tunes and I can enjoy them, but it's not the same like all-consuming immersion that I feel from what little I have to offer. I can kind of groove with that style and with the people that helped create that idiom.
Yeah.
And I know you mentioned in the Larry Grenadier conversation that living out here in LA, we're so lucky because there's so many great musicians. And I happened to come along when a lot of those older cats were older cats.
Yeah.
And too many of them are gone now, but there was still enough of them and enough in them that just by being in their presence, being on gigs with them, getting calls from them when all the good bass players were busy, mm-hmm. when they had left the ranks, you know, and gone off to the jam session in the sky. There's just a story to be told about, and it's been told in the Central Avenue Sounds book and in the recordings that accompany that. There have been studies, but I have a autobiography of Red Callender, which he sort of narrated to a co-author. And the foreword to that book quotes a jazz critic from the East Coast who said, yeah, there really wasn't much happening out on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. I think of Hollywood as just very cheap. I'm paraphrasing. Commercial music of the movies and not much to say about that. And I'm so glad, because he had read Red's book, so glad that Red is filling in the blanks. And I thought, that's so condescending and so ill-informed, especially mm-hmm. for a jazz critic. And even recently, there's a guy with a Jazz Wax blog who said, oh, I came across some Red Callender recordings. He was no slouch.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a pretty left-handed compliment.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece for the International Society of Bass publication. It's probably too long for them. It's like over 5,000 words. But I wanted to combine what I had learned from him with a lot of the stuff that he talked about in his book, which included coming out to California from his native Virginia, I think, with a touring band. He loved LA right away. And his first gig was with Louis Armstrong. And like a week after he landed here, he made his first recording. He was 21 years old with Louis. And he got so busy when the road manager for Armstrong invited him to join Louis's band, he turned him down. Mm. And everything that happened, he was in the right place at the right time because he had the personality, he had the chops, he had the looks. I mean, they liked him in the movies for that, but also his musicianship. And so he became part of the Central Avenue scene, even though he wasn't native to it, but he was connected to the guys whose playing so appealed to me. And I thought, and again, this I don't want this taken inappropriately, but along the way, I've been told, well, you play black. Mm. And I think, I don't know how to describe that, but I think people know that there's a kind of a approach to every instrument that reflects maybe a tradition, again, from the blues or from gospel or from the swing era in the hands of Coleman Hawkins and the guy, you know, the players in Duke's band, players in Basie's original bands, where it was a black music. Now, upon my discovery of the producer of Sweet and Hot, I came to know that there was a whole lot of jazz that was raised by white people and white players. And I'm not saying they were mutually exclusive, but you know, having hung out at Sweet and Hot and having played there, there was the Sweet and Hot sensibility or mentality or demographic.
Yeah.
And then there is other, like in LA alone, the two streams. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a very, especially these days, a very delicate topic and very subject to all kinds of interpretation. I just want to acknowledge the debt that I feel to the black music tradition. And I'm lucky that the players that accepted me did so without regard to race or whatever. But it just was something that I gravitated to without thinking, now let's see, what black musician haven't I played with? I've only worked with three this month. You know, it wasn't about that. It wasn't about notches on my belt. It was just, this is the kind of expression that worked.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, when I hear you with Larry Fuller, for example, I hear Ray Brown, I hear Ray and Oscar. You know what I'm saying? I mean, do you sense that you're part of a continuum there, or that you're drawing upon, again, not to go back to the race thing, but just that we are the we are the beneficiaries. I knew Benny was in there somewhere of the of that tradition.
And of course,
there's another tradition that's parallel and sometimes in the same wavelength. But I've, since Sweet and Hot, become busy with traditional jazz players who play a little differently. They swing, but it's a little different. It's a little more up and down, and not so much side to side.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Of course. But
I think it all belongs in the same family. I just think, you know, it means whatever it means. We're part of the scene, and we're happy, excuse me, when we get to play with people that we resonate with.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Does it feel good?
Exactly.
Yeah, and consciously, if someone calls me to do something and I know I'm not going to enjoy myself, or because I'm not going to enjoy myself because it's not my expertise of music, or it's just not something I really enjoy,
right,
I'm not going to force myself to do it. I'm going to give someone else an opportunity. You know, I'm going to call up, oh man, this person, that's their bag. They love this. And not force myself to get, you know, make the gig happen.
Right.
Yeah. It all comes back to feeling.
Amen. Nothing more than feeling.
I'm not going to keep you on for too much longer, but I am interested in when did you abandon your teaching career? I don't mean to say abandon, but when did you have the courage to be like, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm doing the bass, and that's it?
That's a great question. I don't remember when, but I do remember a feeling that the decision was coming closer. I was teaching, and I was asked to sub for John Clayton. Mm. On the day that his brother Jeff was getting married, and the wedding was being held on Catalina Island, and so John was going to be at the gig, but not in time for the downbeat. Mm. So I was there for I think a set and a half with Rosemary Clooney,
oh wow,
singer, and Jeff Hamilton was the drummer, and Rosemary's musical director was John Otto, piano player, and great sax tenor player from the Tonight Show band, whose name I can't remember, was it? And so I was, sorry?
Pete Kerslake? No.
No, a little older, but a wonderful guy. And he was kind of a comic foil for Johnny Carson. He always had a deadpan expression, but if he had to speak, he always knew exactly what to say. If I think of his name, I'll email it to you in a week. So the gig went great. John came, finished the gig. It was a great hang in the green room with those guys. And then a day or two later, her piano player called me and said, Rosemary loves your playing. She, we're going to do a weekend at the Fairmont or the Mount Mark Hopkins in San Francisco. And I thought, oh, God. Mm-hmm. I had the teaching thing clawing me back. Yeah. And I thought, this could be really something. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, I have this commitment. He said, don't worry, no problem. You know, we'll get somebody from the Bay Area. And I bled psychically from that. And so it wasn't long after that, but I was able to teach part-time and still play. But the problem was the gigs would go till 1 or 2 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Then I'd invariably have an 8 a.m. class. And then I got Epstein-Barr, which was chronic fatigue kind of thing. So I was told to drop everything and go someplace warm and quiet. So I ended up on Kauai and hung out there for a while. Then I got offered to play gigs over there and the same kind of English teaching at the local community college that I was doing here. So I essentially just traded time zones for the same schedule. So I spent a year there on a gig on the North Shore and another year in the capital of the island of Kauai. And then it was enough. I mean, I realized that the palm trees sway, but they didn't swing. Mm. So I missed the grease. I was taking secret trips back to play with Plaz or Ernie, and I didn't want everybody to think that I had cut off my connection to the mainland. So the teaching continued a little bit part-time when I came back to the mainland, but then I realized this was not something I really wanted to do. And there's a lot of preparation in the teaching profession, which a lot of my students probably doubted the way I taught, but you have to really have lesson plans and pay attention to their compositions. And it had run its course for me. It was, I'm glad I had the experience, but when it was time to go, it was time to go. Mm.
But so the last thing I'll talk to you about is, you still are a teacher cause you took the reins for Buddy Collette's Jazz America. So you still found a way to teach and like you've probably seen hundreds, you've probably taught hundreds of kids since you started with Jazz America.
Well, unfortunately you were one of them. And it's almost like when we were called to a school, it wasn't Jazz America yet. Buddy knew somebody in the school district who said, there's kids rumbling after school. We got to do something. The Armenians are attacking the Hispanics and the, you know, the ethnic kids were getting out of school at 3. The parents weren't coming home from work for a couple hours. So an after school program was created. A buddy put together with some other people, Jazz America as a nonprofit. We went to the worst school in that area, found a music room with instruments in all forms of disarray. I think there might have been a couple of diamond in the rough basses there, but I wasn't thinking that way. But we got things fixed up, had kids, had great instructors, Volunteered for a couple of years after school. Then grants started coming so we could pay the instructors. Buddy was featured in the LA Times, and we just went from there to three additional schools as an after-school program. Sam Most was one of the instructors, Gil Bernal, Marty Harris, Fritz Wise, John Stevens, all great players, some of whom didn't have that much teaching experience. But, you know, you learn kind of on the gig, and you find out what kids can do and what they can't, are willing to do. And it's now a little more than 25 years, hard to believe, that Jazz America has been teaching. And I run into musicians every now and then. Weren't you with Jazz? Didn't you have black hair at one time? And I went to that band director's academy at Lincoln Center that essentially Ellington runs a couple of summers ago. And I ran into a former Jazz America student there who's now a music teacher up in Washington State. So you and the Jamel Deans and the Darren Deans and some of these other kids are out there as a result of, not as a result, but having gone through the program. And it wasn't the be all, it was not meant to be a conservatory, but just a way, as our motto or as our, mission statement would put it, to perpetuate the jazz tradition. Mm-hmm. So we weren't looking for the Berkeley commercial route. It wasn't a cutthroat deal. It was just, here's some Count Basie, here are some standard, here's some trad jazz. So we still start the year off with a trad band and start with that original Dixie Cup material, knowing that if you're going to take a solo as a bebopper, you're going to have to know melodies from, you're going to have to know that, Donna Lee was originally another standard with a title that escapes me, but you would know.
I do know. Back Home Again in Indiana.
And that tune.
I couldn't tell if that was like a dramatic pause or.
Yeah, I felt like a teacher again. And the name of that tune was Katie, Miss Theroux. so it's a great thing for me because it makes, as you know, teaching always makes you a better musician because you have to think the whole thing through. And you don't want to misinform your students, and you want to refresh and continually revisit the material. And listening to it, like going backwards, I was into bebop before I was into the early stuff. So Jazz America and Sweet and Hot pulled me back into Big Spiderbeck and J.C. Higginbotham and those amazing players from the early days of jazz. And the recordings are you know, spiky and distorted, but the musicianship was just out of this world. I mean,
oh, I know.
Mistakes, they were well camouflaged because, it was a goofy time. It was a lot of silly stuff was written, and but the playing, and now I'm doing some jazz cruises and some festivals where there's a trad component because trad is a cult,
both
in, with respect to audiences and players. And boy, if you don't know the verse to Limehouse Blues, you might be kicked off the dinner table where you sit.
Yeah. No, I did a festival. Again, this is one of the things where they called me to do it, and the person said, well, it's trad sometimes. And, you know, they call on stage, like, you know, Susie ate chicken on the way home. And I'm like,
B flat, right?
Yeah, B flat. And, you know, it's like the A section is 10 bars, and it's...
Exactly.
So, but I did learn it's, you know, you just, you have to have your ears open.
Exactly.
Richard, the only thing I'm disappointed about is your lack of puns this conversation.
Well, I'm so sorry to disappoint you. I mean, I maybe as some small compensation, I probably shared these with you earlier, but during this pandemic period, I've been doing some decomposing, and there are some titles. I don't have them all committed to memory, but we're inspired in different ways since we're not able to play with our fellow players very much. But of course, these would be reworkings of known pieces like, oh, I COVID the waterfront.
Yes, I like that one.
And so these you've heard. I see you face before me. Mm-hmm. Vaccinate in rhythm, which George Gershwin might have appreciated. There was a waltz from the 60s, I think, called Wives and Lovers, but we're calling it Wipes and Lovers. Mm-hmm. And then as a kind of tip of the sombrero to Carlos Santana and to the governor of New York, there's Oye Cuomo Va. Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout. This could be streaming.
It could be a whole new profession. You could change professions again. I liked a tisket, a casket.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, thank you. That's a little macabre, but yes. You know, if you like it, then I appreciate that. And there are others, but you know, probably not worth dredging up. But thank you for asking for puns. I mean, it would be remiss of me not to to lay a few bad ones on you and your long suffering audience of me. That is. Well, you've been a delight. You're so smooth. Nobody knows that this is not easy to do, to maintain
conversation. To talk to you? No.
Right. No, it's never been easy. But I mean, just to do what you do, it's almost like, it's a little bit like your bass playing, because you stay grounded. You know what the roots are. You know the story that you want to develop, and you're supportive. You let your sideman, in this case, me, just ramble on. I know I took too many choruses, but maybe we can edit them out. Now, for those who are who want to see this, and I can't imagine why, but I have an elderly aunt who doesn't believe that I'm a musician and making a living from. I'd like her to know how to find this. So if there's a platform or a,
I'm going to send you everything.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Don't worry, we're going to make your aunt believe. But I want to thank you so much for the talk, because you're really living proof that you had this seed planted in you, this great music. And then I love those aha moments. It's like you heard that Stefan Grappelli record and you went with it and you left your other career. And it didn't seem like other than you getting Epstein-Barr, probably from being exhausted.
Right.
Other than the illness, you just went for it. And I think a lot of people don't think they can do that.
Right. Well, and there was a movie some time ago called The Gig, and it was a bunch of guys who were in various businesses, but in the summer they would all take their instruments up to a resort in the Catskills and play. And one of the guys was a professional. He was a bass player. And one of the other guys thought that he could become a professional musician. But at one point, toward the end of the movie, the bass player pulls this guy aside and says, I'm sorry, but you don't have it. You ain't got it. Yeah. I mean, it was pretty cold water over his head. But as much as we want to be inspired and want to go for the brass ring, if it doesn't turn out that way, in fact, the Jazz America family came to me just before the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. We were rehearsing every Saturday, and they said, what do you think? Should Johnny stay with music only, or should he have a minor in college? Mm-hmm. And it was so ironic that within a week, the question answered itself. Yeah. But I said, if you're asking the question, you should probably have that minor, because if it's not a passion that you're willing to suffer for to the extent that music may not be enough to live on, then go for, you know, study something.
Yeah.
That you can fall back on. And it works differently for different people. I mean, some people say, if it's something you're going to fall back on, the music is going to fall back. Mm, you're not mm-hmm. going to be as driven. In my case, I had no problem. It wasn't even a debate. The only question was, well, when do I let go of the music, of the English teaching? Because mm-hmm. I was doing enough. But our culture, in a way, says, well, you better have that sure thing. Have that requirement. And if that means enough to you because of your upbringing or your sense of insecurity, then you have to honor that. Yeah. So it's just, it's an individual choice, but I'm glad that you are who you are and that you've stayed with it. And have you ever had any pull toward a different pursuit, or was there any
pressure? But it's funny, you hear people will say, you know, people say things to you. And I remember one year being at the Newport Beach jazz party and Chuck Berghofer vehemently saying, don't study music, be a scientist, you know, because they're just, the field was fear, you know, what's happening. But no, I always, I liked English. I can't even think of words right now, and I like them. But yeah, no, it was just a nice path, and I like teaching. I love teaching, so that helps.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I feel unworthy, but so honored to be in the same Mount Rushmore as those distinguished cats that you've interviewed, and I know you're going to branch out into other realms, but it's so great that you're the bass player you are, and that you've connected with the Christian McBrides and the guys of, excuse me, that we all just worship and respect. And it's fascinating to hear how you draw them out and get them to share some of their secret sauce.
Well, thank you, Richard, for sharing your secret sauce today, and go Dodgers.
Yes, and as they say in the business, virus con Dios.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Katie.
Bye.
Bye-bye.